Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Weekend Water Cooler. I'm Jean Bolduc, your host, here with Matt Hughes. And Matt, my recollection is that are you still the president of the Orange County or chairman of the Orange County Democratic Party? What's left of it?
Well, what's left of it is a lot.
Yes.
Yes, I am.
That's right. It is a lot. That's right. Well, you know, on our last program, I talked with Michelle Johnson, Carrboro Alderwoman, and one of the things that we talked about was the disconnect, the sense of disconnect. I'll put this on myself, that I feel that it is a little bit hard as a matter of experience to relate to the idea of how the voters in the presidential election have expressed their primal scream of dissatisfaction with government, you know, as in the largest umbrella sense of the word. And part of the reason is that the government in our community, the Orange County government, at every level, in my experience, is quite responsive to people, and that the citizens are more like you and me than like most Trump voters. They are organized. They are talking to people inside and outside of the government. They are welcoming of the exchange of ideas. It doesn't mean everybody agrees on everything, obviously. But if they are unhappy with a county commissioner, they go knock on the door and they go talk to the county commissioner. They reach out and touch their government all the time. So it's hard to wrap your head around somebody feeling so apart from the government and how the government helps all of us in many, many ways. That makes it a little tougher to relate to the dissatisfaction in the national electorate. So I wanted to wind back a little bit, if only for nostalgic reasons, and talk to you about the convention. You went to the Democratic convention.
Yes.
In Philadelphia.
Yes.
And tell me about that experience.
Well, it's the second time I've been to a Democratic convention. I had the opportunity to go to Charlotte in 2012.
Great.
And this was different, of course. The previous convention I was able to attend, we were renominating President Obama.
Right.
And, you know, there was no contested primaries and,
right,
and whatnot.
Right.
There were some weird things that happened. You know, like in West Virginia, 40% of the Democrats there voted no preference in the primary in 2012. And some guy, I think, managed to get on the ballot, even though he was in prison. I guess things that only could happen in West Virginia. So this was just different, right? We had the ability this time to nominate the person we thought would be the first woman president and arguably the most qualified candidate
ever.
Ever, but definitely, because you go back to the founding fathers and, you know, they led a revolution. Like, I don't want to say ever.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
But in modern history.
Certainly. Yeah. Certainly the person.
No one has experience to build a nation. I don't think you can surpass the experience of building a nation.
Of creating a country, right.
In modern history, certainly one of the most qualified to ever seek the office.
And without a doubt, a person who spent the most hours in the White House before having the job.
Right.
I mean, that's one thing about becoming president is that it's extremely uncommon for someone to have spent years living in the White House without having been president.
Right.
So unless you have, a case of the son or daughter of a president, which happened with George W. Bush in the modern era, but he didn't live in the White House with his parents when his father was president. He visited there from time to time, but he didn't have a role in government. And so Hillary Clinton is a person who probably, if not certainly, logged the greatest number of hours before.
And the only other person that comes to mind is someone who spent a significant amount of time in the White House before running for president themselves would have been Robert F. Kennedy.
Right.
Having been his brother's main advisor. As well as the attorney general.
Right.
So he would have had a very intimate look into what it would be like to be president without actually being president or vice president themselves.
Right.
So, you know, it was a great experience. It was a little rocky at first, mm-hmm. Between the different sets of delegates, you know, the folks who supported Bernie Sanders and those of us who were supporting Hillary Clinton. But I'm very excited. I was very excited about attending the convention, and very proud to have been a Hillary Clinton delegate. I really don't have any regrets. You know, if the primary right. were held again today, I'd still cast my ballot for Hillary Clinton.
Right.
It was just an amazing experience.
Yeah, yeah, and a very, very well-run event. I mean, you know, event management at that scale, that's a big, big job. So I know that Commissioner Penny Rich was there as well. Mm-hmm. Did you see her there when you both were there?
We ran into each other a few times, but she was in what they call the gallery.
Right.
So she wasn't able.
She wasn't a delegate.
Really, she wasn't
just
a delegate.
Attending.
She had to,
right.
You know, she had a special pass that got her in
right.
Into the convention. But we did run into each other at different social events.
Right.
And
right. So that was so great. You know, seeing. On Facebook and across social media, seeing local folks. So and that's what I mean about the sense of connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you personally know two people who are there at the convention
right.
and they're posting selfies with media people and all kinds of fantastic Democrats
yeah.
At the convention. That was just I just thought a glorious event that week. It was just really, really exciting.
The only downside to the trip to Philadelphia is we managed to show up during the hottest week on record.
Yeah, that's not good. But at least you had an inside job for that week.
Yeah, but still, you're walking around. You're trying to
right.
get from event to event.
Right.
It never quite got cool. Until like the last day we were there.
Well, yeah, because President Obama showed up and then everything got cool.
Of course.
Yeah.
But other than being there during the hottest week on record, it was actually a very
when else is going to be the hottest week on record will be that week next summer because of the mythological climate change
it's a hoax concocted by the Chinese.
It's the most fantastic hoax ever, I think. It's extremely convincing. Whoever's in charge of that hoax, they're doing a great job.
And they need a raise.
Yeah, because they have all these scientists convinced of it. And it's just – it's one of the better hoaxes that you're going to hear about. So that was – now, is that when you met Secretary Clinton or you met her separately? Because was it during one of her trips when she came to North Carolina?
It was one of her trips to North Carolina. In fact, it was her first trip after – to any state, actually, after she had gotten the nomination. So she had her speech in New York City the last days of the primary. I think that was the California primary.
All right.
And so a few days later – her first trip to any state was to North Carolina and Raleigh. So I was able to help put that event together for the campaign and had the opportunity to meet Secretary Clinton.
And how awesome was it? Just tell the truth.
It was pretty cool. you know, I've met President Obama also backstage at an event. This was during his reelection campaign. You know, there's folks, Democrat and Republican, who have their negative thoughts about what Secretary Clinton is like. But all those stereotypes of maybe she's aloof or, you know, not a warm person or whatnot, you never get that.
That is really not true about
her. You're sitting – I mean, you speak with – when you're in those types of events and those opportunities to meet people you know, the exchange might be 30 seconds, right?
Right.
But in those 30 seconds, you know, you're there, you're talking, and you're out, and they're bringing in the next person. But for those 30 seconds, one of the remarkable things that I've learned, whether it's President Clinton, Secretary Clinton, mm-hmm. or President Obama, or the Vice President Biden, is you're their focus for that 30 seconds.
You are the center of the universe.
And
right.
they couldn't be more engaging.
Isn't that amazing?
Trying to get to know you or relate to you in just that quick moment in time. So I mean, I wouldn't trade the experience for anything.
And it's just an amazing skill that really accomplished politicians have, and it's difficult to explain. It's like a cone drops around you, and it's just the two of you, mm-hmm. even if it's only for a very brief time. But you really do feel it in their presence. I met a guy. Oh, watch this. I won't remember his name. It's probably 25 years ago, and he was running for state senate, I think. He came out to an event at the Orange County group home for people with AIDS in Carrboro. He came to the groundbreaking ceremony that we had, and he came over, and I was president of the board at the time, and he came and talked to me, and he talked to me, like you say, it's like 30 seconds, it's a minute, whatever. But it was just like, you know, him saying, you know, I'm so proud of you. And I felt like my dad was talking to me. You know, it was so personable and such a quick and effective connection that he had. His eye contact was everything you could ask for. He was completely engrossed in talking to every single person there so that they would understand that he wanted to come out there and express his appreciation for every person who worked on that. And, you know, this was in 1990, 91, 92 in there. Those were difficult times. Mm-hmm. You know, we had some real enemies in that cause. But the people who were with us were really, really with us. And that's one of the ways that expresses itself.
Absolutely.
So it's a great thing. So we'll take that happy note, and we're going to take our first break, talking on the Weekend Water Cooler with Matt Hughes, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back on the Water Cooler. Gene Bolduc here talking with Matt Hughes, the chair of the Orange County Democratic Party. And Matt, I need to know something that's going to be fun to watch in the next 4 years.
Okay.
You're going to have to help me with this.
All right.
I don't know if it's going to be the hair or the wardrobe, or as I talked with Michelle in our last program, I said, well, there's going to be Trump steaks and Trump wine and Trump this and Trump that. You know, I just can't even imagine how the White House is going to be made over. You've seen all the memes on Facebook about all the golden lettering that's going to be slapped across the White House. Do you think Donald Trump will serve for 4 years?
Well, I don't see why he wouldn't serve for 4 years.
You don't think he'll be like Sarah Palin and say after half his term, I've had enough of this.
Well,
it's too hard.
You never know. And the only – other than Richard Nixon, the only time a president has not served served their full term is – Because
of tragedy. Nobody wants that. Nobody's advocating for that.
Or some people were just, you know, called home. You know, the president that served in office for 30-some days because he caught pneumonia.
Yeah, William Henry Harrison. Should have worn a jacket,
you know,
man.
I think he'll probably serve four terms. I would prefer
for
him.
4 years, not four terms. Don't say that.
4 years.
Oh, my goodness. I think lightning just struck the building.
A term of 4 years. if only because I do believe that Donald Trump is malleable in terms of his ideology. I don't think it's a rigid ideology. I mean, this is a man that really 8 years ago probably was a Democrat and gave to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. So I do think that
– I believe that's true, by the way.
On some measure, he might be malleable politically. However, it's – Mike Pence, who believes in conversion therapy for gay people.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want Mike Pence to be president.
I would, you know, that's one of the things in the George
it's
H. Kind,
it's
the
kind of H- like, it's kind of like, you know, my very, very progressive friends who wanted Bush impeached. I don't think they thought that through. If
no,
Bush
exactly
were impeached,
right.
Then you
yeah,
have Dick
I
Cheney.
I don't know that you really want Dick Cheney as your president, and that's one of the reasons that I, speaking to only for myself, felt very protective of George H.W. Bush while he was president for one term because I felt like, oh, my goodness, Dan Quayle, I just can't even wrap my head around how scared that made me.
Well,
I just thought
he was
a nitwit.
His ability to spell.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess you'd get spell check, I guess. You'd have – that would be a person probably who followed him around correcting him on tomatoes and potatoes. But yeah, I just thought he was, you know, I thought he was more conservative than his boss, and I thought he was a nincompoop. So you know, I said, yeah, let's just ride it out and let HW serve, oh, yeah, and we'll just get through it, and then Bill Clinton will show up. And so he did. And there's a lot of people believe that that was because of Ross Perot, because of that third party element. I'm not sure that's really true. There's some scholarship on that now that says, nah, you know, he's still – that would have split about evenly. And
well, it may have split evenly, but it may have also have helped.
Yeah.
It may have helped. But, you know, the thing that I am continuously amazed by is the Electoral College. I think Ross Perot in 92 shows that, you know, you could capture 20% of the vote and not get a single electoral vote.
Isn't that amazing? Wow.
But also the fact that this is – since 92, we've had 8 presidential elections. If I'm recalling that correctly, we've had 8 presidential elections, 92, 96, 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012. 2016. Okay, 7 presidential elections.
Right, right.
Democrats have won the popular vote in all but one of those.
Right, right.
But we didn't win every election.
That's right. Ralph Nader in 2000. Wow, what an impact with a tiny amount of the electorate.
So I do believe, and I used to not think this, but I do believe it's time for the Electoral College to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, for example, Maine and Nebraska allocate their they have some statewide electoral votes and they have congressional district electoral votes. And, you know, conceivably, if more states did that, then you might have states like Louisiana that will never go blue, but they have a Democratic congressional district.
Right.
Or Arizona, because the funny thing is a lot of these red states, like Arizona, like Utah formerly, up until very recently, but a lot of these red states have at least one Democrat. So at least one of their electoral votes would go to the Democratic candidate.
Right.
The problem that is in that system is you had a situation like in 08 where Obama pulled off a feat where he actually captured one of Nebraska's electoral votes.
That was amazing.
Well, one of the things he did was gerrymander that district of Omaha to A, make it harder for a Democrat to get elected in that district, but also B, to make sure that a Democrat was not going to carry that electoral vote.
Right.
And Trump
really serves the people of Nebraska at all.
But Maine also, one of their electoral votes went to Donald Trump. One of the few times that's ever happened. A more rural district. So that system obviously wouldn't be perfect either because you could just gerrymander your districts. Now, conversely, even in a gerrymandered system, you know, Hillary Clinton would have gotten 3 of those electoral votes out of North Carolina.
Mm.
But I think that going to the popular vote, I think, is really what we need to do so that if you had people who are progressive who live in Mobile, Alabama, they're actually contributing to the turnout.
They might actually become engaged.
Right. Because their vote is going to count just as much as someone who lives in Boston.
Right.
Because, you know, in Boston, you may feel like your Democratic vote counts a lot more because you're going to be a blue state.
But, you know, in Boston, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, they probably just feel like they're throwing their vote on the pile and, yeah, it runs up the score, but it's not going to turn anything.
Right.
But in this case, it would matter.
Yeah. And then I'm sure there are people who live in Los Angeles who are Republican who feel like their vote's not counting in
that
California.
But
if you're doing solely popular vote. Now, I do think what that does is it shifts a lot of the elections to the urban centers because you'll be able to rack up a lot more votes.
Right.
But it may make more sense then for a candidate who is a Democrat to or a Republican to stump in areas that you wouldn't ordinarily stump in.
Yeah.
Because they are going to give.
Well, I mean, it does make that shift, but it makes that because that's where the people are.
Mm-hmm.
That's where most of the people are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, elections should be probably something about the people,
yeah.
about where the people are.
There are places in the South that, you know, you look at the map and you look at it on a county basis and you just see a lot of blue.
Right.
That blue isn't impacting the state race. But those are folks who want to be represented. And, you know, a lot of New York State, you look at a map, you see cloisters of blue everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
But then you see a lot of red.
Yeah, New York is like Pennsylvania, is actually an extremely diverse state,
mm-hmm.
and it really was a tribute to Secretary Clinton how she comported herself in seeking that Senate seat, that she traveled to every county in the state and her listening tour, and said, "Listen, you know, I didn't grow up in New York, and I need to learn about your county and what you're about." What your needs are, and by all accounts, she was did an impressive job of introducing mm-hmm. herself to all parts of the state and folks who may or may not have tended to support her as a candidate. But at least they felt like they had the opportunity to directly engage in dialogue with her on some level, or
right.
understand where she was on the factory in their town, and mm-hmm. and this sort of thing. So that they could make that decision based on what was in front of them instead of what they heard or what they knew from a history book.
Now, I will say with questions about turnout and things like that, you know, Donald Trump won this election basically with the same number of votes that Mitt Romney won
right.
in 2012. It was Democratic turnout that went down in some pretty critical states. You know, I was convinced that if she won Virginia and Colorado and Nevada and held on to basically every other state and won Pennsylvania, that she didn't need Iowa, she didn't need Florida, and she didn't need Ohio. But that part of her blue wall
right.
Didn't work out. And I think that really the adage that when Democrats don't vote, Republicans win holds up, because we saw
right.
that there was a decrease in the votes. It's not that Trump won more votes than Romney did.
Right. It's where he won them.
It's where he won them
right.
and where Democrats didn't turn out to vote. And I think you also cannot discount, and I'm sure there's people who are listening who supported Jill Stein, you cannot discount the impact of Jill Stein in this race, because in some of those areas, in some of those states, her vote numbers in some cases exceeded the margin of victory for Trump and Clinton. And I don't think those were voters who would have been voting for Donald Trump.
Right, right.
So not quite a 2000 situation, because it's not 500 votes in Miami-Dade County or wherever it was. But clearly some folks did exercise a protest vote. And while I don't believe that those votes are wasted votes, I do believe that they have consequences.
Right.
And I think those consequences are that we had extremely progressive folks who would like to continue, more than likely, the Obama legacy, who voted for someone who was not a viable presidential candidate and possibly helped deliver the White House to Donald Trump. And, you know, people vote how they want, and that's fine. But that also means that maybe the Democratic Party needs to do a better job of turning out our base and giving folks something to vote for.
Right, right. That's a good place for us to pause for just a moment. Talking with Matt Hughes, the chair of the Orange County Democratic Party, here on the Weekend Water Cooler at 1360 AM and 97.9 FM WCHL. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Dragging Matt Hughes through the decompression process after our national nightmare wound up on Election Day with an outcome that he and I, without embarrassment, will tell you is not what we wanted. But we love America. We love the process. We love voting. And one thing that in our community, you know, might get overlooked a little bit because of the reverberations from Washington is that our bonds passed.
Right.
Hallelujah, our bonds passed. I had Penny Rich in here the other day, and one of the things that we talked about was the bonds, and she pointed out, which I think maybe people didn't realize, talking about making the argument about what to vote for and having people really understand what they're voting for, that in voting for the bond or voting against the bond, you're not voting for whether or not the schools are going to spend money to fix a roof or build a new school. You're voting for getting the best rate, that interest rate that the county can get on borrowing the money to do it.
That's right.
And that if you, when you vote against bonds, that's by and large what you're voting against. You're just saying, oh, no, don't spend the money. Don't plan on spending the money. Wait until it's an emergency or, you know, whatever. There is important messaging on every level of politics about what it is exactly that you're voting for.
Right.
And I feel like, I bet you do too, that there is a mountain of better outcome that we could get in media, in particular in journalism, for how we cover politics. I was very discouraged by the amount of emphasis on the horse race. This person's showing this in the polls this week, up 2 points, down 2 points. You know, talk about the polls once a month. You know, you're covering a race for 18 months,
right,
for 2 years.
Right.
I really don't need the up or down this week, that week. And now it's turned out that a lot of what the polls seem to be telling us isn't really clear that was accurate, that there's, you know, polling is a really complicated business.
It is really complicated. And I think if you look at some of the states, you know, Pennsylvania, you know, of that blue wall, you know, I think the polling held up in most of the states. I think everyone knew that Florida would be close. The polling showed that Florida was going to be close. But
you can't poll really on turnout, right?
No, but, you know, also maybe the polling understated Hillary support, understated Trump support. But I think in most states the polling was pretty accurate. You know, a lot was made of the tightening of the polls in Arizona and in Georgia.
Right.
Well, Clinton lost Georgia. The gap between her and Trump were 6 percentage points. She performed better in Georgia than President Obama did 4 years ago. You look at Arizona, she lost that state by 4 points.
That's all? Just 4 points?
She was 4 points.
That's
is what
close.
Separated her. And part of it
that's
is
remarkable.
Maricopa County is 60% of Arizona, right? So 60% of Arizona's population. It was 4 points between them and that state.
Wow.
In that county. And if you compare that to 4 years ago, where Mitt Romney beat President Obama by double digits.
Wow.
She actually, in 9 different states, outperformed President Obama. So I think there are some silver linings, because I think what that shows is, even with the discontent, even with you know, a lot of the issues in this campaign, she was able to actually do better. And these are not, you know, the two I mentioned, Georgia and Arizona, they weren't states with a huge Clinton operation.
Right.
It was more natural. And now that could have been partly changing demographics. That could have been a reaction to Trump. But that shows that maybe we do undergo some sort of realignment, where the new blue states are Virginia and Colorado and Nevada, and the purple states are becoming – you know, that are coming up are Georgia and Arizona. And, you know,
I think that's true, what you just said.
And I think that also, if you look at a state like Texas, if that does become competitive, if that does become
blue,
then
tectonic.
Then the Democrats would have two large prizes assured electorally.
Right.
Plus Texas being in play. And even Texas was closer than it has been in the past. Is Austin
expanding in Texas?
Yeah, I don't know enough
about
Texas politics.
I would love to see Austin take over the state of Texas.
But, you know, I think that at some point, you know, one-party rule, it does become unsustainable in a lot of states. And you know, the other thing that I think we really have to look at is there were some weird gubernatorial elections nationally. We lost Vermont and New Hampshire in the gubernatorial races, but we picked up, if the numbers hold, North Carolina.
Hallelujah, please say yes.
And we maintained West Virginia and Montana, states that Trump won by double digits. So my question that I would want to know is, what are those Democrats doing in their home states?
Right, right. And that's where some of the scholarship needs to go, is what happened there.
Right. To these voters, these white voters, in these very red states
in some cases. And, you know,
West Virginia, you know, a state that we say is traditionally poor and stereotypically, you know, poor, their gubernatorial, their soon to be governor is a billionaire.
Yeah, why did that happen?
You know,
why did that happen?
And he largely self-funded his campaign.
He actually did it, though. He didn't just say he was
doing it. The Republican in Montana, I think, was also a billionaire, and he funded his campaign as well. And Ron Johnson, who defeated Russ Feingold almost on a coin flip, he's also another billionaire who has funded his campaigns in the past. But I really think that, you know, these are states that will probably never win on an electoral side.
Right.
Every county in West Virginia went for Trump. But yet we had
a really good win. A Democratic governor to them.
Yes. And so there has to be a way where we can elect more senators, we elect more members of Congress, maybe more governors, because the way I look at it is, in order to get the majorities back in Congress, we just need numbers, right?
Right.
A senator from West Virginia is not going to be Speaker of the House.
Right. That's
right.
But
they add to the number.
Yeah.
And you need some of those more moderate, possibly conservative folks from those states to add to those numbers. But then a Democratic president will need governors who are willing to implement policy in good faith. And I think that that's important.
Yeah.
As well. So,
and boy, that particular element of governing in good faith.
Yes.
And that needs to make a comeback.
It does. And you know, you had last year in Louisiana a governor for the first time in since Katrina, Hurricane Katrina,
right.
A Democratic governor there. So, you know, I think what that shows is there's some lessons that we can learn to maybe turn our fortunes around. But I think that where we've had some of these wins and where I think the Democrats really need to do a better job is this rural-urban divide.
Right.
It can help you to an extent, but you can't rely on it too much.
Not too much.
You can't rely solely on your metropolitan areas to deliver your wins. And we have to do more outreach, because I think that those folks are the ones who are angry, who feel disaffected, that they've been left out or they've been left behind. And those are voters that Bernie Sanders spoke to in the primary.
Yep. That's true.
And I think that we have to, you know, a lot of the states he won in the primary were these more rural states that felt like they had been left behind. So we've got to, as a Democratic Party, really shift our messaging and our outreach and how we go about reaching out to voters and really going to where they are and not expecting them to come to where we want them to be.
Right. I like it. We're gonna take our last break, and then when we come back, we're going to wrap up our closing moments with Matt Hughes, the chair of the Orange County Democratic Party, here at the Weekend Water Cooler on 1360 AM and 97.9 FM WCHL. Don't go away. We'll be right back. We're back for our final thoughts with Matt Hughes. the chair of the Orange County Democratic Party. Now, Matt, the world must go on. Incredibly, somehow the sun came out yesterday and the earth kept spinning. And so, gravitational pull and the mm-hmm. science of how planets move actually is real science that nobody's arguing about still. So my questions for you are, what happens next when it comes to the possible changes that could come about? I hear a lot of people talking about HB2 and the change in the governorship. If that does happen, there will be a recount or a review of the count. I'm not sure legally which that is actually. In North Carolina, but that'll take a week or so, and they'll sort that out before they certify the outcome. And the governor is rightly, actually, not conceded the race to Roy Cooper until that's resolved, which is the right thing for him to do. When that is resolved, if it's resolved in Roy Cooper's favor and he mm-hmm. becomes our next governor, there's a lot of people who are very excited that, well, that'll be it for HB2. But it's not that easy, is it?
No. Like the Democrats said with Donald Trump, you can't do it alone.
Right.
You do have to have a team in place. Maybe the legislature organically will send a Governor Cooper a repeal bill. There certainly seems as though there are some more moderate Republicans who are in favor of it because of the fallout
right.
With HB2. But a Governor Cooper cannot do it alone. Now, the good thing is a Governor Cooper would have the ability to counteract some of that. You know, we forget even if there's not enough Democrats in the legislature, he would have an entire state government apparatus.
Right.
With the Department of Commerce and others and maybe working with an Attorney General Stein to see what we could do to mitigate the harm of HB2. But that's where I'm looking forward is being creative, almost like President Obama was, creative in how to govern when you have an opposition party that controls both chambers and is
right.
not interested
right.
in helping you govern.
Right. And he does have the power of his strong advocacy as the governor of the state. That he is a single person who is voted for directly by all the people mm-hmm. of his state. And if he does, in fact, confirm that he has won the support of all the people of his state, then he would have that as a mandate to stand on that the people are with him on this.
Absolutely. And I think also, there's the gift that Jim Hunt gave to his successors, and that's the power of the veto. He never used it himself. He got it added as a constitutional amendment in 96.
Thank you, Jim Hunt.
And Governor Perdue used it a record 17 times, more than the only other governor to have that power was Governor Easley, and he only used it a few times here and there. That might be one way we at least slow down bad legislation.
And he could hold other legislation hostage until HB2 is reversed. If he would choose to use that as a tactic, that's been done by other governors too, to say, no, don't send me that bill. Don't send me, the other bill that you want to do. I'll work with you on those. But first, we're going to have to get this out of the way because it's the best thing for the state.
Well, I think the good thing is, unlike our current governor.
I know I should wake up.
unlike our current governor, I think that Governor Cooper knows how the legislative process works.
Right.
Knows the power players in Raleigh
right.
and how to use those levers of power. Governor McCrory basically was a figurehead in
mm-hmm.
Charlotte.
Yep.
And most of the reasons why Charlotte is a good city, a great city that it is today, is because there's a majority of Democrats sitting on the city council.
City council. That's right, a very strong city council in Charlotte. Well, Matt, I am so happy that you came in to help me get through my post-election malaise. I don't even know what the word is for it yet. I'll have to come up with a new word. I thank you for coming in to
You're
talk
very
with
welcome.
Me about this.
Anytime.
And I feel very confident that Orange County's future Democratic Party is present and future is in good hands under your leadership.
Well, thank you.
So thanks a lot for being with us, and we'll see you all next week.